You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. Hey guys, and welcome to episode 302 of the podcast. And in this one, I got back on Dr. Amy Mariaskin. Amy is a licensed clinical psychologist and director at the Nashville OCD and Anxiety Treatment Center. Now, in this one, I got her on to talk about her new book, which she is writing. The title is A Work in Progress, but it's pretty much something about thriving in relationships with OCD. So we delve deep into that. What's it about? We talk about the importance of relationships. We discuss the psychological idea of attachment theory in relationships. We discuss relationship OCD, the importance of relationships, OCD and friendships. She also takes us through an experiential exercise around developing exposures to face OCD and strengthen relationships. We talk about values and committed action towards those values. We discuss disclosing OCD to the people you care about and much, much more. Relationships are important to many people. We are social beings, so they can make up a big factor in our well-being and our life. So I'm glad to cover this episode, and I'm happy that Amy is writing this book. And thanks as always to NoCD for supporting the work that I do. NoCD offers affordable, effective, convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. If you wanted to find out more about their therapy services and whether they take your insurance currently, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories, or the link will be in the episode description. And thanks to you guys, as always, for listening to this podcast. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Dr. Amy Mariaskin. Welcome back to the show, Amy.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on. So first, you know, it's been, as we were discussing a moment ago, say about a year and 3 to 4 months since we last spoke, at least on the podcast. What's been up with you since that time? Obviously the pandemic, but
yeah, I know the pandemic, and the pandemic in Tennessee is an interesting place to be for the pandemic. I think we had the dubious achievement of being number one in the world twice for our transmission rates. So not quite the first place that I was vying for, but yeah, you know, against that backdrop, I have been, you know, continuing to, well, I kind of stopped growing my clinic here in Nashville because we ran out of physical space, number one, and number two, just really wanting to, you know, have everybody in the clinic become more of like a community, a team. And so trying to like bond and support each other, because being a mental health, being in mental health in the field at this time is just really tough. Yeah. So I think like we need each other as therapists, just like we sort of say that we need, you know, that people with OCD kind of need each other and need that support. So that's been what's going on there. And then I'm really excited about a project that I guess we'll be talking about, that I'm writing a book. So those are kind of my big updates.
Awesome. Yeah. It's good to hear that you and your staff are kind of looking out for one another, and that's only going to benefit the clients as well. Mm-hmm. You know, because if you're all overstressed and overworked, you're not going to serve the clients as well. So it's good for you and it's good for them. Okay, so your book, anything, and what do you want to say about it, first of all, and what is it and what will it be about?
Yeah. You know, what's funny is I just realized I don't actually know the title, because we've gone back and forth so many times. So I will just say the first part of the title, which is Thriving in Relationships with OCD. And this, so the book's, you know, like I'm in the early stages. It's not going to come out until December 2022 with New Harbinger. But when I was thinking about writing a book, I was thinking about couple of things, like what am I seeing with my clients? What is coming up? Where are they? Once they've gone through a combination of kind of some evidence-based treatments and just some, you know, just general being kick-ass humans and doing the work and you know, conquering various parts of their OCD, like what is kind of like what's left over. And it's about living with OCD. It's about living with OCD and nurturing parts of your life with the kind of, you know, the ways in which, you know, our brains continue to throw thoughts at us or things like that. And that those voices might be much quieter. Those imperatives or urges might not feel as compelling. But, you know, what does it look like then to do things that are important? And a lot of my clients talked about relationships. That's what's important to them. So talking about how do I find a partner, like a romantic partner? How do I navigate certain social spaces? How do I decide about things like disclosure, say at work or with family? How do I parent with OCD? You know, what does that look like? And there are some, there are certainly some resources in some of those areas and then very few in others. And I was finding this sort of like regardless of age. So even my littles just kind of talking about some of their friendship struggles or things like that, or teenagers, you know, who do I tell, or middle schoolers who are like, I don't want this to sort of be like used against me, right? And like the gossip mill. So that's how I got to the idea of writing about relationships and OCD, and then kind of looking into, hey, what's out there? Because I didn't want to just sort of add to, I mean, there are so many incredible books out that I had a lot of and continue to, and will continue. I plan to continue after the book is published to have imposter syndrome. Like that is, I've planned that for the next 20 years. Like the, you know, the benchmarks keep changing, the feeling's still there. But yeah, that's just a little bit about it.
Amazing. Amazing. So, as you say, I think it's important. Relationships, what makes us human, that connection with different people from different walks of life, that adds a lot of meaning to our lives. So the book, how much of it will be actually linked to therapy versus, as if when I say therapy, I mean it from like an ERP perspective versus it being therapeutic, but not ERP.
Right. Great question. Yeah, it's definitely a self-help book. So it's written to provide some tools and skills. Mm. And those tools are derived from a number of different modalities. That was kind of the freedom. I mean, when I think about myself as a clinician, ERP is going to be the number one modality that rises to the top. That being said, you know, there are people for whom ERP only partially does the job or doesn't really resonate at first. And so I loved that I was given the liberty to cull techniques and sort of perspectives from some other things like, well, ACT and mindfulness and self-compassion. And I think whenever you're writing about relationships, there is that kind of interpersonal slant on things. And so like even going back and sort of looking at attachment. And again, it's tough because the feedback I keep getting is like, okay, this is for a lay audience. You know, people don't use that word or don't use that academic sort of conceptualization, which has been really cool because having permission to just come up with like metaphors and I sort of feel like I'm talking to a friend when I'm writing the book. So there's been this weird meta process where I'm like, oh, I'm sort of developing a relationship with my reader as I'm talking about how to develop relationships, as I'm also holding in my mind that like, how the heck am I qualified to be like talking about relationships? So it's been a lot of fun. I won't say it's like super easy because I don't think it's hard work to write a book, but it's like, but it doesn't feel like work because I love it.
It's a lot of work, but yeah, it's not work, if that makes sense. Like a lot of effort is maybe the word I'm looking for. Okay, yeah, and attachment was an interesting thing to bring in. You know, when I was doing my dissertation recently, I was talking about attachment in part, and there's quite a few studies now specifically at attachment for OCD or looking at attachment as part of, you know, or the attachment styles of people who have OCD. And my training was heavy on attachment, particular like model of attachment. So I just, I guess attachment as a technical term is way more understood, I think, than a lot of other therapy terms, because it's become popularized in the mummy and daddy circles and, you know, on those Instagram pages and blogs, and that's awesome. There's nothing wrong with that. Anything else you wanted to say on attachment?
Yeah, I think there's some really cool research on attachment as it pertains, and you've probably seen this in your dissertation, but attachment as it pertains to ROCD symptoms and the idea that, a couple of basic things about attachment and OCD, which you, I'm sure, saw. So there are relationships between both avoidant attachment and anxious attachment and OCD. So like relative to people without OCD, or relative to people without any other kind of clinical concerns. That being said, I think a really cool thing about attachment is that, you know, I think early thought about attachment is like, okay, well, you know, this is what happens early bonding. And I did parent-infant research early on in grad school. Mm-hmm. And so this idea about like, okay, this is attachment is solidified at this age, and then you just carry this into adulthood. And we know that's outdated, right? But I think for a lot of people thinking about like, I think sometimes when we can put ourselves into these attachment categories, we fail to see the nuance of like, well, perhaps, you know, my anxious attachment, quote unquote, some of these behaviors, these like grasping behaviors or notions of like scarcity in relationships that I sort of like need that touchstone. We can either pathologize that and say, you know, like, well, that's a bad thing. We all need to be more secure. Or we can pathologize those as compulsions. And also like that's human behavior. And so I think, part of this is about not really about seeing like what behaviors are working in relationships and what behaviors aren't working, as opposed to sort of slapping a label on it and then getting really black and white and wanting to kind of like criticize yourself, which I think a lot of people with OCD are already really good at doing, unfortunately.
Yeah, really interesting. And it's always attachment and how that obviously everyone has some form of attachment, but specifically around relationship OCD and how that comes into play. Like, I don't have any answers. It's just something that's always fascinated me of that particular theme of OCD. It strikes me as something that may be important to think about at least.
There's with ROCD kind of if you think about, there's the relationship focused ROCD, which is about, you know, is this person the one, or do they love me? Or it's really about the relationship itself. That tends to be in sort of early research that there's a preponderance of people with more anxious attachment style, as opposed to the partner focused ROCD, where it's more focusing on imperfections in the partner, may have a preponderance of more avoidant attachment style. I don't think that there's, you know, enough research to be like, this is fact, but it makes sense. It's one of those kind of studies where it's like, okay, yeah, that's your propensity. I think of avoidant attachment as being like always looking for the exit, right? And so it makes sense that you'd be looking for your threat appraisal would be about like, well, why is this person not working out?
Yeah.
As opposed to how can I make them love me more?
Yeah. Good points. Thank you for answering that. Interesting book. So let's get into actually a couple of questions and then we'll get into an exercise. So you've kind of touched on it, but why the importance of highlighting relationships or writing a book on relationships?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I'm seeing clients are bringing it up in session. Also, there are so many ways that OCD can isolate you, right? Isolate someone from support, from being able to be out in the world in a way that allows them to meet people or to get support that way. But also in those kinds of like the shamefulness of it and the secrecy of it and all of that kind of stuff that I think, as somebody who had, you know, I had most of my OCD symptoms when I was a kid, and, or rather they were kind of most prominent then. And it was like, how did I know, quote unquote, how did I know at age 6, 7 that like, this is too weird to talk about? Yeah. And so from an early age, sort of like taking a piece of your identity, your experience, your whatever it is, and sort of cordoning it off from other people, that was another goal for me, to help people kind of break that down and take those risks of reaching out and connecting to others and sharing those parts of yourself, because not because everybody's going to welcome you with open arms, but because it's worth the risk that the people who matter will, you know, and will be there for you. And I think that's, sometimes like as a therapist, I'm like, wow, I have this incredible honor and privilege of being able to hold this in the room with you. And, you know, with my clients, while, you know, you've not talked to anyone else about this. And, one of the things that I often tell people is like, that sounds really lonely. And a lot of times when I say that, people start crying, and I noticed that like loneliness, like you said, as humans, I mean, both from an evolutionary perspective and sort of what we know about attachment, we are relational, social animals. And, so I guess that was another big, big impetus.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. Yeah. And I guess it got me, you know, you sharing got me reflecting on, you know, me as a 7, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, and experiencing OCD symptoms and thoughts, and not, like you said, not wanting to share that because I was aware that this is nuts. You know, these things I'm thinking, I can't share these. And if I do, it's going to get me in trouble or in danger, or, and you look at that from an attachment point of view. I wanted to stay safe in the relationship, so I didn't share these things. You know, that was a protection mechanism, but ultimately I don't think it really was protecting me. I think it was hurting me. I can't remember why I brought that up. I guess just maybe highlighting from working with young kids or having young kids, it's important we try and create that comfort so they can share, because if they're not sharing, if I think about myself, I wasn't therefore able to show up in relationships a lot of the time and be present in those relationships. And therefore my relationships weren't as strong as they could have been, because I was always hiding an aspect of me if I was triggered or flared up or whatever. And maybe being able to express that means I can show up every time to every relationship without feeling like I need to hide, which is then going to strengthen relationships and then ultimately probably reduce OCD a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And that idea too, about like developmentally. So when did you first get OCD, and like, what were the kind of developmentally, what stage were you in with relationships? And like, when you look at the littles, a lot of that is about kind of like, friendship, you know, burgeoning friendships, and also kind of independence from our family systems. So like, I see a lot of the littles who have OCD also have separation anxiety, because it's like, well, home is the only place where maybe I can be a little bit myself. Which again, has attachment implications. And then people who are kind of like, you know, teenagers or early adulthood, knowing that that's another spike in age of onset. And kind of how does that affect, how you conceptualize yourself sexually or in romantic relationships, et cetera. So I think it's all really, I look forward to, I think this is going to be a huge area of research. And if there are any researchers out there who want to like do this work and want to collaborate, it, as long as I don't have to do statistics or write the methods section, I'm in.
Yeah, sounds good. okay. So, next, let's talk about friendships and just any research around friendships and OCD.
Yeah, this made me really sad on two accounts. So one thing that made me sad was that there's not much with adults, not much research with adults and friendship. And that just made me sad, because I'm like, oh, I'm interested. And we sort of have these, a lot of evidence of general social, social impairment or like a paucity of social interactions, but they never parse out or rarely parse out friends. The one study, the cool thing is one study of adults that I found, this was Himmel and colleagues found that the adults with OCD had just as many friends and just as strong of friendships as people without OCD. And they posited that that was partially because when you're an adult, you get to choose your friends, right? So you can be like, hey, you're cool, as opposed to family, or like when we're kids and we're just, you know, it's kind of like whoever's in class next to us. And then the other part that was sad is like the kids and their friendships. When kids have OCD, they have fewer friends. They have more worries about making friends. They experience more bullying, and they experience lower confidence in their ability to make friends. So even the kids who may have social skills, independent of kind of like, you know, how good they are at it, they don't think they are. They have this sort of like chronically low confidence. And I see that in my clients, my littles. So that's kind of what we know from a research side of things. And yeah, I think that's an area where we could do a lot more work.
Yeah, it's crucial for people's developing sense of self at a young age. Friends and friendships are very important. Obviously, it's important in adulthood too, but I think you're somewhat more formed in adulthood. Obviously, everyone's always changing, but that young age, you're very much, yeah, everything's connecting. Okay, so you've got an exercise in the book, which helps people generate exposure ideas based on their relationship values. Do you want to walk me through that, or walk us through that?
Yeah, of course. And I will have this. There are different iterations of this exercise in the different chapters about, you know, for friendship and romantic relationships, parenting, et cetera. But the general concept is, to identify these kinds of relationship values, and then to find, kind of think about, okay, what would my relationships look like sort of aspirationally if I were living in accordance with these values, kind of, you know, 100% or 99%. And then to kind of do a little bit of a self-inquiry about, and how does OCD prevent that? Or how does OCD make that more difficult? And that in those little areas where you see that kind of, where you see OCD getting in the way, that you can generate exposures from that. And even the word exposure, when I use it in this context, it feels a little bit, harsher. It's like, just like, what do you want to do? And like, how can you feel motivated to do it because of what you want and deserve in your relationships? Yeah, we can kind of start with, let me see if I can actually bring up the text of this one. We can start with kind of having, so a lot of times in ACT, when you're trying to identify values, there are various ways to do it. And I know these have been covered in the podcast, but you can kind of do it in a, you know, sort of an intellectual way. Hey, here's a list of words, which ones resonate with you. Here's a bunch of cards, sort them in order. Or in the spirit of ACT, you can do it more experientially. And it was interesting to me in looking at ACT, a lot of these kinds of values clarification activities are already sort of relational. Like there's the one, I don't know if you've heard of the one where it's like, imagine your mistakenly held funeral and you're somebody's giving a eulogy and it's like, what do you want them to say? Oh, yeah. So anyway, look that one up. It's if you like morose, yeah. It's really good. It's very effective. But here's one that we can do together where I want you, I guess you, the listener, to imagine that you are walking in the woods and you kind of see this clearing and you notice a strange kind of oddly shaped helmet with the words Brain Jumper 3000 written on the outside. Okay. It's misty. It's weird. You're getting a sci-fi vibe and you pick this up. You're like, what is this? And so you pick it up and you put it on your head. And when you do, you gain the ability to enter the mind of others and observe their thoughts. Even better, you get to listen to their thoughts specifically about you. When you jump into the mind of your best friend, what do you hope to find that they think about you? How about when you jump into a family member's mind? What would you hope to hear from a romantic partner's mind? These questions should reflect your ideal answers as a friend, family member, or partner. If you don't have someone in that role right now, even better, it's okay to create one and think about what you would love to hear them say. So that would be kind of, and I've done this with my adult OCD treatment group, and they'll kind of write down some of the things, you know, I would hope they would say. I mean, do you mind if I ask you, like, what comes up for you? You can choose one of those relationships.
Ask me one again, because I was just listening and kind of visualizing the scene, but not actually doing the answers.
So what about, like, when you jump into the mind of your best friend or a very close friend, what do you hope to find that they would say about you? What do you think about their thoughts about you?
Probably that I'm caring, playful, careful, caring, playful. It's definitely one other word, but it's not quite coming to me. Passionate, probably.
Cool. So I think with that, because a lot of times when we do values exercises, things will come up, like, you know, faith or athletics, or there are things that aren't inherently, they can be about your relationship with, like, an activity or with, you know, a system of faith, but they might not be how we want to be with other people or what we want for other people to see. So you said passion, playfulness, and kindness.
Caring.
Yeah. Very cool. So I want you to kind of keep that in mind. I feel like you're a bad example because you, like, do all those things. You're a therapist. You do a podcast.
I try to do all those things.
Stop living up to your values so well. You're making this exercise hard. But anyway, yeah, it's cool, right? Like, what was your experience of doing something like that?
It was nice. It was warm is the word that comes to my mind. When those words came to me, it was nice to think that my friends would think that, you know, maybe I felt close in the visualization to them. And it's definitely from, like, a confidence or self-esteem point of view. It's a nice little boost.
And I know that for some people, this can be really hard.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's hard for them to even imagine kind of accepting that the sort of hypothetical caring mind melded thoughts of others. they're pushing back against it. So there can be some work to do there, but yeah. And so with that, I love what you said. So you're feeling that closeness, you're feeling that warmth, keeping that in mind and knowing that none of us is, you know, 100% living out all of our values all the time. Are there certain things that you would like to do, or that you want to do, to demonstrate these values of being a caring, passionate, playful, kind person, like with friends? Can you think of some things that, that you would want to do in those relationships?
Yeah, I think I, from the caring point of view, would like to particular friends call more often just to check in on them. The desire is there. Sometimes I let life get in the way and don't act on that, you know, and make those calls. What's the other one? Caring, passionate, and playfulness. Playful, I think I am good at doing that with my friends, and I think that's because they're playful as well. That's their value, one of their values. But again, two of my closest friends don't live near me anymore. They're actually in different countries now. So it's harder to be playful online or over the phone, although it's not impossible. So maybe it would be ways of developing that playfulness, over something like Zoom or a phone call, or even We are playful, I guess, in like our messages on like, well, I use WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. And then passion was the last one. Ooh, I don't know about that. Passion, I guess, in terms of interest. So we have similar interests, definitely in terms of sport. Again, it's harder because they're not close anymore, so we can't go to games as easy. So I guess it would be ways of connecting remotely over our various sports teams, mm-hmm. which we do to a point, but maybe I could definitely do more.
Yeah. And so that's great. I love that. And I feel like, you know, from an ACT perspective, we just kind of did some values clarification and converted those values to what we would call committed action in ACT, which is another one of the six aspects of the Hexaflex. And then what I like to do in this part, you know, you don't have to divulge anything. Mm. But the final part is, and the part that kind of makes it more OCD focused and a little bit more about exposure, in a way, is to the extent that OCD or, you know, or anxiety or lack or depression or a lack of self-confidence, to the extent that that is getting in the way for anyone doing these exercises, for them to kind of clarify like, huh, well, let's say, for example, let's say that somebody says, yeah, I want to call my friends more often. But I find myself, I get caught up in rituals. I tell them I'm going to call and then I get caught up in rituals or something like that. That would be an example.
Yeah.
Or I want to call them, but then I kind of talk myself out of it because I'm like, I don't want to bother them. Mm. Or I talk, you know, unkindly about, well, I'm probably annoying. Mm. So that would be sort of the next step. And then if it's too big a leap to go directly to, okay, I'm going to call them X amount of times a day, or yeah, I'm going to do this and that, what are some steps along the way? So how can we make this sort of hierarchical and gradually and progressively with OCD in tow? Because, you know, that's not something we can control. How can we kind of commit to those actions and strengthen those relationships?
Yeah. 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 I like that. Yeah. Cause the things I shared, OCD isn't affecting that. That's, I think, more down to my laziness and prioritizing other things. But yeah, in the examples you gave, yeah, it makes absolute sense how OCD would interfere with certain things. And I've heard that from some of my clients. Yeah. And then with the committed action, but then that last bit around finding ways for OCD not to get in the way, but yeah, does that make sense? Like how are you working with them to see that committed action through? Because that's the exposure effectively.
Right. And I think for a lot of people, there's this huge gulf between the committed action and what I feel capable of, what I feel worthy of doing, you know, what I feel I deserve. There's often a gulf between if I were committing to action that sort of typifies these values or really strengthens them, then, you know, I would have to be a different person. My OCD would have to be better, or I would have to be, you know, I guess both from a perspective of symptoms get in the way and also from a perspective of, again, like I said at the beginning, I deserve it. I'm worthy, you know? And so I think it's in a way, it's an exposure to, like acting as if you deserve this, acting as if, which, you know, I think people do, everybody deserves to be able to have the kinds of relationships that they want, and kind of breaking it down into smaller component parts. And so if it's something like, and you can do this as well, if you don't have, you know, I have different parts of the book. We'll talk about both relationship formation as well as relationship maintenance. Maintenance is like the least sexy word for, you know, what I mean by that is to kind of like deepening them.
Yeah.
Maintenance sounds like robotic. Yeah. So I think like, yeah, what are those discrepancies? And then, okay, it's okay if that feels like it's too big a leap to just jump into doing these things, but what is the first step? You know, what is step one? And are you willing to try that? And then in the spirit of ACT, instead of doing anxiety ratings on like a traditional hierarchy. Well, I do have people go ahead and put their anxiety ratings, but I also want them to put their willingness ratings. So how willing are you to do this? Because there might be something that's relatively anxiety provoking, but it's so important to you to foster this relationship. You know, parents with OCD who have intrusive thoughts about their children, and they say, you know what, this is like a 9 out of 10. I'm so nervous to give my daughter a bath. And it's a 10 out of 10 in willingness. Because I want to be able to have, she's plays in the bath. It's her favorite time and mom can't be there or something like that. So it's really clarifying. That side of things.
Yeah. I like that. The willingness is it's not the reward, but it's more like positive versus the fear. Cause if you're just rating the fear or the anxiety and it's a 9 out of 10, well, why would I face it? You know, it was the willingness. It's a 10 out of 10 and this is why, then that's the motivating factor to take the risk and do it.
Yeah.
Perceived risk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so some of the other kinds of activities to this effect are things like, you know, thinking of a memory that you have with, in a relationship that was important to you and then kind of, you know, going back and thinking, you know, what were you doing? How did you feel? What were you giving and receiving? Because I think that's a kind of relational way to think about things. Did you feel a sense of safety, adventure, nurturing, caring, community, playfulness? And so lots of different ways, because I know sometimes, some people, like, I love experiential exercises. I can just kind of go there and then, you know, lose myself. And I think for some people it's really stilted. So I wanted there to be multiple ways to kind of get to this and to be really frank about, like, there's no one way to get to these values. And there's no rules about which values are, you know, should be important.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. I like this exercise as a way of, it's not just doing exposure then, it's doing exposure in a way that pushes you closer to people. Mm-hmm. And you said, like, meets new ones or strengthens existing, which I think is only going to benefit the person, hopefully. Yeah. So, all right, excellent. So next question is, I guess it, like, disclosure. So you did mention it earlier, but disclosure can be a daunting idea. And for some, it's worth me saying right off the bat, they don't have to disclose to anyone if they don't want. But yeah, just anything you wanted to say on disclosure in different relationships and, like, either like safe and effective ways to do so, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think whenever this topic comes up, I wish there was a really nice, tidy how-to guide, a sort of if-then, like, ask this question of yourself, and then this one, and this, and this, and this. And you know, it obviously it's more complicated than that. But I think going through, as you're looking at disclosing to different people, and again, I think we could, you know, there could be a whole episode on, like, sort of like pros and cons of disclosure in romantic relationships, family relationships, work relationships. But I think a lot of times with disclosure, one of the things that is important to think about is kind of like, what do you want? What is the function here? Like, is the function intimacy? Is the function, I feel guilty if I don't, you know, because I do think moral scrupulosity can get in the way of disclosure. And so there are a lot of times I'll get this kind of panicked question, like, well, I don't want to disclose, but am I lying if I'm not? That kind of thing. So I think if it's symptom informed, then you want to kind of take a step back and say, like, hey, is there, like, what would the other kind of benefits be in terms of doing it in a, you know, in a safe way? I always say, like, well, think about, you know, what evidence do you have of how this person has responded to either other people's kind of mental health disclosures? Like, do you have any evidence of that? How have they reacted to other times that you've demonstrated vulnerability? And is that something that Did you feel that you were, that you got care or rejection? I'm really hesitant, Stu, because I'm worried people will like do this almost compulsive. Like you, I mean, you can do anything compulsively, yeah. but I think, yeah, thinking about number one, what do I hope to get out of this? And then number two, the question is does that feel reasonable within the context of who this person is and what they've demonstrated? And then number three is always that gap between, you know, OCD or anxiety is not going to, we're not going to know 100% and we're not going to feel 100% safe. So is it worth that? Does it feel like a leap across the Grand Canyon and you're likely to fall in? Or does it feel like, you know, it's just, you know, it's a few feet and I'm willing to do this.
Yeah.
I actually don't even know if I can jump a few feet.
Yeah.
It's not a great metaphor.
No, I get it. And yeah, ultimately, you know, people take anything you've said at their own risk, you know. it's not black and white, as OCD likes to try and make things. Everything is 50 different colors and then scales within those colors. So it's using your own judgment. But yeah, they were good guidance questions though, to get people thinking. And also like culture comes into play, both in the United States, you have different cultures, different religions, different XYZ. But also listen to this podcast, there's different countries, you know, and different countries are maybe not as like progressive as the States or the UK and you know, and that's yes. obviously a whole different thing. But obviously people listening know that, and then they'll hopefully consider that and then make a judgment. But yeah, I think sometimes there are many times that disclosure would be absolutely fine, but they're very much worried or OCD is interfering with it. And then that's when the work needs to be done, I think, because those people are then unnecessarily suffering.
Right. And I think it's OCD is probably going to warn you about all the potential pitfalls of disclosure, but thinking about the positives, thinking about, you know, for example, like this is a slightly different situation, but when parents, if I'm working with a child with OCD and the parents say like, we don't want the school to know, we don't want anyone to know, sort of thinking about, well, okay, but then, you know, if the papers are coming around the classroom and your child's refusing to touch the papers or refusing to follow, you know, classroom protocol because they're worried about contamination or they're worried about, or they're taking a long time. Do you want for somebody to be understood, their behavior to be understood within the context of these are compulsions or, you know, like in a romantic relationship, it can be the difference between you seem really distant versus, hey, are you having those intrusive thoughts again? How can I help you? How can we collaboratively kind of get out of this, or, you know, disrupt that pattern. And I guess that's one other thing with the exercise is that another thing is you can take this to that other person and you can say, hey, here are my goals. Here's where OCD is getting in the way. I really want to be there for you in this way. Here's the way that I'm working toward it. And that might increase motivation too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Get the loved one or friend or family member in on it. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. So 20-year-old self, pick up the phone and call her. What do you tell her? I know I've asked you that before, but.
I didn't think you'd do a repeat.
Let's do 30-year-old self.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So I'm generally a person who cares less about like my age number getting higher than I do about whether or not it's a prime number, because I find prime numbers very unkind and unfriendly, and I've never been a fan of them. That being said, 30, a highly divisible number, for whatever inexplicable reason, that is the only age at which like I had right before my birthday, I just like started freaking out and I was like, oh, I'm getting old. I'm getting, you know, I had this like sort of reckoning of, you know, well, frankly, like, yeah, how many of my years were lost to worrying about what other people thought or mental health concerns or perfectionism or whatever it was. And it really blindsided me because, again, what a great number 30 is. Anyway, So I would go back to her and I would say, and it's interesting because I think I told you my birthday is actually tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I would tell her if it were, you know, right now on the eve of her 30th birthday, I would say, you have no idea how much life you have in the next 11, 12 years, all the things that you're going to do, all the people you're going to meet and have the pleasure of interacting with. So you're really, it's this whole getting old thing. I understand that. I have compassion for that. Don't beat yourself up for it. You're not superficial for feeling that. That happens to people, but get ready, get excited. Like, here it comes.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. And then you've got a billboard in Nashville. What do you want written on that billboard or drawn on the billboard?
Ooh, I get to do a drawing maybe.
Okay.
Oh, Siri had Siri. Siri had an idea about that. She's a matter of business. Well, you know, maybe I'm just feeling sort of sappy after this conversation, but I think it would be some kind of like a drawing of, oh, it's so corny, but I'm saying it. Maybe it'd be like a drawing of the world, and it would have a bunch of people like in a ring around the world, and they would be holding hands, and it would say something like, let's all love and respect each other. And nice. I'm going to immediately regret that, but that's my answer.
Hey, it's a nice message. Just to analyze that for a second, like, what, you know, because if I said that, I may feel a bit embarrassed too, but what does that say that we're embarrassed about wanting the best for everyone, including ourselves, you know?
I almost feel like it's this, like, it's interesting because I feel like sometimes those, the tropes of like kindness to each other, like holding each other in respect and all that stuff can feel like it's sort of failing to acknowledge how hard it is to do that. And some of like the inequities and the strife and the, like, you know, the differences. Yeah. But that being said, we're in an extremely polarized time now, I think globally, but definitely in the US. And it just seems like that kind of kindness and humility and like being there for each other and trying to understand each other is really important.
Yeah, I agree. It maybe does take away a bit of the difficulties to get there, but it's a goal, you know, it's the North Star. So there's nothing wrong with that. Okay. So lastly, anything else you wish you could have said or shared today?
No, I think we covered it.
All right, cool. Well, thank you as always for coming on and sharing this exercise. I really enjoyed it. And it's something I'll probably do with my clients as well now.
Awesome. Well, that's great to hear. And I'll look forward to next time.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care. Thank you.